Tonight on the Daily Debrief, a campaign advisor to President Donald Trump reports to prison, and the disappearance of beauty queen Tara Grinstead heads to court for the first time in years. Also, the former college president seated in the defendant's chair in the Larry Nassar sex abuse case. That's straight ahead on the Daily Debrief for Monday, November 26. And good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Debrief. A former foreign policy advisor to the campaign of President Donald Trump has been ordered to report to a federal prison today. George Papadopoulos entered a plea deal with prosecutors connected to the Office of Special Counsel Robert Mueller on charges of lying to the FBI. The lies surrounded his contacts with alleged Russian agents and officials during the campaign. Papadopoulos's plea deal required him to forego his rights to an appeal in return for a light 14-day sentence. But now Papadopoulos wants to appeal, so the judge wants him to serve his full sentence. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross is with us on the Debrief tonight. Brian, this is a complicated case. Papadopoulos reported to prison around mid-afternoon, though, I understand.
In Oxford, Wisconsin, to what they call a prison farm at the lowest level of security. He played a strange game here in the end, Aaron, because he went before the judge initially when he was being sentenced, showed his remorse, admitted his guilt, and then once he got the 14-day sentence, he began a campaign along with his wife, Simona, to essentially say, it's all lies, I've been set up by Mueller, there's more here. And essentially, he contradicted everything he said in court, and his original lawyer, a Chicago lawyer, dropped him as a client because of that.
Incredible, because when you enter a plea in return for a light sentence, you are agreeing to some culpability here, and that's what he did. And now he's saying, I didn't agree to anything. I was stonewalled or whatnot into this.
Well, right. He sees a vast conspiracy essentially echoing what President Trump has said about Russian collusion and the involvement of Mueller, and Mueller's not legitimate and shouldn't be able to pursue this case. And his argument to the judge was that Mueller may be found to be not actually able to carry out these cases, and he should be let out of jail or kept from going to jail until that is resolved. The judge said that's not going to happen. He got cold feet about just 14 days in a very minimum security prison.
You know, his Twitter account is acting as his what do you want to call it here, his soapbox these days.
Exactly right. And he sent a couple of them over the weekend that were very strange. One had to do with whether he was ever going to testify against President Trump. He said, I never flipped against the president. What I did do, however, was expose the corruption of the investigation for the world to see. This is a man who I came to know over the last year and a half. I actually was, along with producer Rhonda Schwartz, the two people who attended his wedding with Simona in Chicago earlier this year.
I know we have some footage of that as well, just to talk about the bizarreness that
this has become. It was in the basement of the Cook County Courthouse in Chicago. He told us the night before he was getting married the next day. Nobody else was there except Rhonda Schwartz and myself, and we saw the whole thing. And at that time, he was pretty forthcoming about the fact that he had entered this plea. He hoped to put an end to this chapter of his life.
So you've known him for a while.
Yes.
And now he's reporting to prison. What do you make of this?
Well, I think in the end, someone described him once in the campaign as a coffee boy. Essentially, he was a very low-level person. Donald Trump couldn't get any respected foreign policy advisor to join the campaign. He got Papadopoulos and a couple of others, and he got caught up in it. The Russians targeted him, and then when the FBI asked him about it, he lied about it.
All right. Chief Investigative Correspondent Brian Ross, appreciate the insight. You know the story well.
Good to be here.
Okay, folks, let's move along to the next case we're covering tonight on the Debrief. The former president of Michigan State University appearing in court today to answer charges she lied to police about the Larry Nassar gymnastics sexual abuse scandal. Luanna Simon is charged with two felony counts and two misdemeanor counts. She's the third person charged after the Attorney General's office took over the investigation into Larry Nassar. Prosecutors say Simon lied when she told police that she was not aware of the nature of complaints which led to investigations into Nassar. Simon faces up to 4 years in prison if convicted. Here the judge read one of the charges she faces.
You did, after being informed by Detective Sergeant William Arndt and Lieutenant Joseph Kavanaugh of the Michigan State Police, that the officers were conducting a criminal investigation, did knowingly and willfully make a statement or statements to the officer that you knew were false or misleading regarding the following material fact or facts relating to the investigation: that you were not aware of the nature of the complaint that generated the 2014 MSU Title IX investigation of Amanda Thomas-Shaw's allegations, and the officer was conducting a criminal investigation for criminal sexual conduct in the first degree. So this charge is a felony, maximum penalty 4 years in prison and or $5,000 fine, commonly known as lying to a peace officer, violent crime investigation.
Original Larry Nassar sentencing hearings, many survivors called for further action against Luanna Simon and other administrators like her.
The MSUPD handled it beautifully, but MSU officials were a different story. Because the response of Dean William Strample was to send an email to Larry that day and tell him, quote, "Good luck, I am on your side." And when my video testimony to the Indy Star came out graphically describing the abuse that Larry perpetrated, disclosing horrific details to the world that no one was ever supposed to know, that I had never told anyone, even my own husband, until that point, Dean Strample forwarded that video testimony to the MSU provost, and he mocked it. He called it the cherry on the cake of his day. President Simon and Board of Trustees, is this the right way to handle disclosures of abuse on MSU's campus?
Let's discuss today's developments in this case with attorney Mike Korobanics. He's a criminal defense attorney, and he's here on the Daily Debrief after a quick switch. So, Mike, this is one of the moments the survivors of Larry Nassar's abuse wanted to see. They wanted to see Luanna Simon sitting in a criminal court with a plaque in front of her that said defendant, and they had that visual today.
It's a very, very intense case, and it's the victim's impact really, I think, carries a day in these kind of prosecutions. And it's just sad that these so many victims were really put in the very precarious position because those at the top, as alleged now, really didn't follow through or handle this investigation or aid in it.
So this was an arraignment today. Take us through where we are procedurally in this case that's moving along.
As an arraignment, this is really more just a procedure to put this case on track to move towards trial. There's really not much that went on today other than officially enter a not guilty plea. Now they'll set some sort of scheduling as to whether or not they can resolve the case or file motions and when we should get this case moving along.
The next appearance is December 18th, and I know that different states do these a little bit differently, so there are many steps to this in Michigan. We're certainly going to follow the case as it moves along against Luanna Simon. We're following a number of other local criminal trials tonight. First to the Georgia case involving the October 2005 disappearance of Tara Grinstead. The former beauty queen disappeared after leaving a cookout and saying she'd be headed straight home. She did not show up to work as a teacher 2 days later, and that's when she was reported missing. Her phone was at her home, and her car was unlocked in her driveway, but her purse and keys were missing. Ryan Duke and Bo Dukes are two of Grinstead's former students. They're charged in connection with her disappearance and presumed murder. Authorities think Ryan Duke killed Grinstead. He's charged with malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, burglary, and other charges. The authorities think the other student played a lesser role in Grinstead's disappearance. Today, prosecutors and defense attorneys argued a series of issues in the first hearing in this case in a number of years. One issue is whether the trial should be moved to another venue.
You believe that the pretrial publicity has just been so extensive that a figure can't be had? Talking about we don't have jurors here that objected about it. Tell me what your motion is based on.
Well, specifically, Judge, I think the court's gag order in the case originally preventing the press from covering certain aspects of the case and preventing counsel and parties from discussing the case highlights the importance of what has become a national news case for not just the folks in El Silo and Fitzgerald, but people across the world. And the number of reporters here today highlights the coverage that this case is likely to get locally and nationally and across the world, and it's real-time information. Today is different than it was 10 to 12 years ago. Everybody has access to the internet, but the people are still here. People still, I'm sure, remember fondly Ms. Grinstead, some of whom were taught by her, some of whom were friends of hers.
Attorney Mike Korobanix is with us on the debrief tonight to hash out some of the arguments heard in court today. And Mike, there were many. We just listened to a change in venue request. So the judge is hearing a number of these things. It's been a long time since investigators filed these charges. So change of venue has to do with pretrial publicity.
Yeah, as he was making the argument, I was listening to it, Aaron, and with change of venue has really become almost obsolete in today's day and age. It used to be a lot more effective mm-hmm. when we didn't have the internet, when we didn't have shows like Law and Crime, quite frankly, that educate the people. People get to see, you know, how this system works, and he gets to hear about trials. It's no longer where if we move it to the next county, it's not like they didn't get that county's addition to the daily printed newspaper. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult not to know about this case, and I think those are going to be a thing of the past.
Okay, a couple of the other motions that were brought up today. One involved the use of the word murder. The defense doesn't want the state to keep using the word murder in discussing what happened here because they think that if the state keeps saying it, then the jurors will believe, well, that must have been what happened.
Well, I don't really know about that motion. I mean, there are murder allegations here. I know part of it they're saying is something with the conspiracy, but I don't know how you really prevail on that because the position, if I'm the prosecutor in this case, is judge. That's what they're charged with. You will remind them to correct it that they can't be found guilty unless they meet their burden of proof. But otherwise, there's no prejudice to the defendant.
You sound like the prosecutor did in court today, and that's pretty much how the prosecution responded to that one. So the defense also wants the court to refrain from reading the full indictment because the defense thinks that if the court reads the entire kit and caboodle to the jurors, then the jurors will believe that it must be true because it came out of the judge's mouth.
Well, I've heard that argument before, and I know there's some studies out there, but quite frankly, sometimes I like when they read the indictment because it puts jurors to sleep. They stop listening after a while.
So if the jurors go to sleep, well, they're not going to listen. But again, I mean, there's ways the defense can get up there and say, you just heard a lot of serious accusations against my client, but the state needs to prove every single one of them. And in this case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I agree with you. I mean, listen, you don't win cases by arguing about what people read to the jury, because the good defense attorneys, as well as the good prosecutors, will remind them of what their duties are and attack the facts.
Okay, also a discussion in court today in this lengthy motions hearing about so-called full and fair closing arguments. Now, I think Georgia is one of the states where statute places time limits on the closing arguments themselves. But what the defense wanted to go for here was a limit on the state's ability to turn the rebuttal into the big, huge argument, which oftentimes happens. A rebuttal is supposed to attack specific points that the defense brings up in the defense's argument. It's not supposed to be a four-hour-long or however many minute-long closing.
Oh, you know, I'm smiling with that because I do a lot of federal work. And in the federal system, they allow rebuttal. Or as we refer to as the defense attorney, says, judge, don't let the government give a second closing. Because everybody forgets, they get the first and last word, mm-hmm. and the defendant's stuck in the middle. It's very disadvantageous to the defense.
So the rebuttal should be in the eye of Mike Korobanix, the actual rebuttal, not a big lengthy thing.
No, it should actually only attack those points of the summation by the defense that wasn't addressed in their opening, or wasn't addressed by the defense that's opened it. It should be like a triangle, Aaron. It should come and just keep getting thinner and thinner, not expand.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how the judge rules on those. Still ahead tonight on The Debrief, two additional trials are scheduled to begin this week. We will discuss them when we come back in just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. The father of criminal defendant Casey Anthony has been seriously injured in a weekend car crash. The Florida Highway Patrol says George Anthony flipped his wife's 1999 Toyota 4Runner on Interstate 4 Saturday afternoon. A witness told the Highway Patrol that Anthony veered off the right shoulder, then tried to swerve back into the lane of travel before finally heading off the road and flipping several times across several lanes of the highway. There was only one car and only one person in that car. George Anthony's daughter, Casey Anthony, of course, was acquitted of charges related to the death of her daughter, Kaylee, but she did get in trouble for lying to investigators. Time for a check of criminal incidents making headlines. Here is Anthony Velez.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on LawAndCrime.com and across the country. Authorities in Florida released surveillance footage of an argument between two passengers that escalated to gunshots being fired on a bus. The two men, 38-year-old Bendy Alcine and 24-year-old Michael Porter, can be seen arguing on a Broward County bus before a fistfight erupted between the two men. That's when Porter opened fire, hitting Alcine. Alcine was transported to a hospital where he's listed in stable condition, and Porter was eventually arrested. Investigators in Florida ruled the death of an infant found floating in the water off of the Florida coast a homicide. The baby, dubbed Baby June, was believed to be between 4 and 7 days old when authorities found her body floating near the Boynton Beach Inlet in June. The medical examiner determined the child's death was a homicide, and authorities are now offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to an arrest. A woman in Oregon is under arrest after she was busted with a cache of weapons and a large quantity of methamphetamines. 22-year-old Catalina Tess was pulled over after officers in Aloha saw her leave a known drug house. Authorities reportedly found a handgun, a knife, and a throwing star in addition to the large amount of meth in the car. Tess and her three occupants were arrested, and she now faces multiple charges, including delivering meth and being a felon with a gun. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for the Daily Debrief.
Mike Korobanek's criminal defense attorney. Let's talk about that last one here. Okay, leaving a known drug house with ninja weapons. Apparently, that's a way to get in trouble these days.
Yeah, the ninja weapons and a gun and a drug that could put your way out there, that's just not a good combination.
So where does a defense go with something like this?
Well, you would hope maybe you could protect your client's rights and some sort of motion to suppress, because just because you're leaving a known drug house without anything more, it may not rise to probable cause for the search and seizure. You just really got to hope that the police were careful in their execution of that search.
Good points. Let's move along now. We have a couple of other cases to talk about. Three police officers facing a jury this week in what many people are calling the trial of an alleged cop cover-up. You've seen the footage here several times on the Law and Crime Network where Officer Jason Van Dyke shoots and kills a knife-wielding teenager named Laquan McDonald. Laquan McDonald in the middle of your screen there. Three other officers, though, are also facing charges related to this case. Those charges are conspiracy, official misconduct, and obstruction of justice. Prosecutors say the three officers lied in their reports by claiming Laquan McDonald attacked Officer Van Dyke before pulling the trigger. Officer Jason Van Dyke was tried separately in this case. Here is how he described the incident you just saw.
He waved the knife from his lower right side upwards across his body towards my left shoulder.
And when he did that, what did you do, officer?
I shot him.
And when you say you shot him, do you know if you actually hit him or not?
Not really. No. Overruled.
I'm sorry?
Do you know if you actually hit him or not when you shot him?
I have no idea. I didn't know at the time.
All right. Do you know how many shots you fired?
No.
What happened when you started shooting?
I'm sorry?
What happened when you started shooting?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that, please?
Sure. You all right?
Yeah.
What happened when you started shooting? What happened to Laquan McDonald when you started shooting?
Eventually, he fell to the ground.
Did he ever drop that knife?
No.
And after you realized that he fell to the ground, did you stop shooting?
Once I recognized that he was on the ground, I stopped shooting.
Back one more time to Mike Korobanek, criminal defense attorney, who's here on the Daily Debrief. So, Mike, this boils down to accusations of a cover-up. And I have to wonder, some jurors might have been sympathetic to Jason Van Dyke, the officer who was tried of the hefty charges for actually pulling the trigger. They might have been sympathetic to him because they might have felt that an officer in his position could have been worried about what Laquan McDonald was going to do with the weapon. But the officers who are accused of lying in their reports and twisting things around, I don't see as big of a sympathy factor there.
I tend to agree with you with that because, you know, lying in reports goes right to the heart of, you know, every system is based on trust, basically. Mm-hmm. And we trust law enforcement to be there to help us to do the right things and to do justice. When someone lies in their reports, they're going to be used in a prosecution. That just really spits in the face of everything that they're supposed to stand for.
So in this case, where these officers are accused of a cover-up, what defenses might we be looking for here?
Well, I think what you may be looking for here is some of these officers are going to say, I was ordered to do this. I couldn't be insubordinate to my superiors. But those are dangerous. This could be a tightrope defense. You got to be careful where you step because the next one may put you off the rope and you may be working without a net.
You know, I've got to get into the details of this one. Could it also be, though, that they were just filing reports and didn't see it clearly? They were relying on what other people told them, quoting other people who were at the scene.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I mean, I'd really like to see the actual reports they wrote and how they were written and if they were reviewed by supervisors and if they distinguished who told them what.
It's going to be an interesting case. We're going to be watching it this week. Another case we are watching this week that is scheduled to begin is one in Iowa where Mackenzie Kinigi and Philip Williams are suspected of murder over the death of this victim, Jessica Gomez. Kinigi and Williams were dating. Authorities believe the couple killed Gomez in Kinigi's apartment, then went to the store to purchase gloves, bleach, plastic sheeting, and face masks to use in the cleanup. The victim's body was burned and dumped in a field. So, back one more time to Mike Korobanek, the expert criminal defense analyst here on The Debrief. The police apparently showed up at this defendant's apartment, found blood and evidence of a cleanup. The authorities also have the defendant's purchasing the cleanup equipment at a Walmart nearby. This seems like a really strong case for the state.
Well, not to be funny, but they always say sometimes the cover-up's more indicative of guilt than the crime itself. Mm-hmm. And this is an extremely tough case. I mean, circumstantial, you don't need somebody to see something. Circumstantial evidence is much stronger than eyewitness testimony, in my opinion, because there's so many pieces that come together that build what they call a web of guilt.
Yeah, and here, I'm waiting to see how they present the evidence that they actually have these two defendants, but I'm assuming, as in other cases, they're going to have the security camera footage, they may have receipts, things like that. This will be really interesting to watch it roll on. But procedurally here, we have two defendants. Sometimes defendants are tried together, of course, with their own attorneys. Sometimes it's separate trials. Here we have separate trials. To me, that's setting this up to be one defendant pointing the finger at the other as the primary culprit.
Well, yeah, I think whenever you try to divide and conquer, and maybe if you put a strong enough trial against the first one, they will, if they get evicted, they'll try to reduce their sentence.
It's going to be another interesting one to watch, and we expect this one to kick off over the next couple of days here. It's taken a little bit longer to get through jury selection. So, again, Mike Korobenix, we appreciate your insight here on The Debrief.
Thank you for having me today.
And that's all the time we have for today on The Daily Debrief. We're going to be back here with our live coverage of cases around the country starting tomorrow at 9 a.m. on the Law and Crime Network. And, of course, The Daily Debrief, Monday through Friday from 5 to 5:30. From all of us, have a good evening.